Welcome to the Industry Talks podcast, the premier podcast for all the best insider info on the music business. I'm your host, Roman Perry. This week, we have Will Runzel. He's the manager for artists like Nightmare, Slander, and Joyride. On this episode, we dive into his time working as a talent buyer under Steve Aoki, how his overpreparedness has resulted in major successes, and some of his predictions for the future of dance music.
Industry Talks.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you on. So I guess to start off, like, give me kind of your story.
Yeah, there's always two versions. There's the version with all the failures and there's the highlights. Which one you want?
I want the failures.
The failures. All right, cool. Yeah. Those are always fun. I studied sports telecommunication at Indiana University. I had like a radio show and I was talking, I was calling baseball and football games, stuff like that. I went and studied abroad in Florence, Italy. The exchange rate was crazy in 2008 and I got crushed and I ran out of my parents' money. They were supporting me and I got a job promoting basically American club nights there. So I went back to Indiana University realizing that my education, you know, was probably not going to be worth its weight in gold. And I filed an LLC and I started an agency. It was called Fifth Agency. My name is William Lewis Runzel the Fifth, and that's where that name came from. So I quote unquote signed a bunch of bands. I went nightclub to nightclub in Bloomington, Indiana, pitching my acts, and pretty much everyone said no to me. One guy booked DJ Nims for $500. I made $50 that day. I actually waived my commission, and I kind of just he had this place, Jake's Nightclub, 700 capacity venue. They couldn't even get 50 people in there on Saturdays. So I did what I did in Italy. I passed out a bunch of flyers. I got you know, a cool kind of electronic focused DJ to DJ it, and I took the door, and we were doing about 500 per weekend. They were really happy with me, and after about 8 weeks, they wanted to get that extra 200 bodies in the door, so they tried to bring in other promoters. I told them, you know, screw you guys. I made this thing. If I take the week off and don't promote it, and if no one shows up, can I get my old deal back? And they said yes, and everyone showed up, and that was I fired myself essentially from that job, but I had made some
foot a little bit there.
Yeah, in the face, if you will. So yeah. What I did though is I made a little bit of noise in the entrepreneur community, and a good friend to this day, Russell Marcus, contacted me, and he had a number of ideas. The first one was Tundra Music Festival. We had Drake confirmed, and he ended up tearing his ACL in Toronto. This is right after Best I Ever Had came out.
Yeah,
we pivoted, ended up confirming Jadakiss, Shwayze, Jeremih, a bunch of other acts. I can't even remember who else was on there. And it got rained out. It was raining for 6 days before the event, and the university was going to charge us to fix the field that right. we had rented if we did hold the event. So that was my first gut-wrenching, kick you in the teeth, my life is over failure. Yeah. As the worst day of my life up until then was announcing that event had been canceled. So after that, Russell had a connection to New Way Agency in New York, and he said, "Hey, you know, I know this failed, but let's put this guy Mike Posner. Let's bring him to Indiana University." And I had never heard of Mike. I listened to the two mixtapes he had out, and I was like, "Oh, college kids are gonna love this," you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, I said, "Well, why don't we do this at the University of Illinois, University, you know, in Chicago, University of Madison at Wisconsin, and in Ann Arbor."
Yeah.
So we set up a 4 or 5 city tour. All the shows sold out. We made a ton of cash. I thought, you know, that was going to be my career, was throwing concerts in the Midwest. Obviously, it took a different turn, but
yeah, for sure.
That became the backbone of a routing, and we expanded to University of Kansas, University of Missouri, Kent, State University in Ohio, and we had about like 7 to 9 markets, and we ended up routing Currency, Twista, Sammy Adams, Number of Hip Hop, Big Sean. We did all of those guys. We did their first tours in the Midwest. Steve Aoki. And you know, Big Sean was like a huge failure. He wasn't as big as we thought he was. And you know, it was very volatile. And the reason why I ended up taking an internship opportunity, a free internship opportunity with Steve Aoki, is because the company that I started wasn't really going to ever.
Yeah, of course.
It was never going to be anything, you know? So building a company that would never be anything was kind of, it wasn't my first big failure because it brought me to Steve. But Steve basically told me at 3 o'clock in the morning in Iowa City, you know, could I come run his events in LA? And how soon could I move there? And in 5 days, I was driving across the country to move to Los Angeles. That was in April 2011. I made a bunch of flashcards and I studied everything there was about the company. I brought all my paperwork and all my infrastructure from that company, because when you're promoting, you know, an event that's in a different city, you got to have really detailed plans to teach, you know, especially when you're dealing with 20-year-old kids and stuff like that.
Yeah, so
I came with, you know, knowing everyone there, all the releases that they had done. I would studied up on all the events they were doing. And I also came with all these marketing plans on how to promote concerts. And in the first week, they walked into the office and they said, hey, you know, Will's gonna head up marketing here. We were having a lot of trouble booking electronic artists more than like a week or two out. Most of it was just like connections within the company. We didn't really have proper talent buying structure. So I convinced them to let me be the talent buyer as well. And by the time my 3-month internship was over, Steve brought me a cake. It said like Will Runzel, director of events on it or something along those lines. And, I started booking everything and I started marketing everything. So, you know, like I was telling you earlier, we booked like Zedd first, we booked Dylan Francis first, we booked Iggy Azalea first, all, you know, their first performances, Flume, RL Grime and Flossardamus' second show, Dylan, The Magician's first show, Anna Luno's first show. So a lot of cool debuts in the 12 months that I was there. After 12 months there, I wasn't making that much money, and we sold out a ton of shows that year, and I got a job offer from React Presents, who are a Chicago-based company, but they had gotten a contract with a bunch of nightclubs in LA. And so I started booking Lure Hollywood. I started booking a couple other nightclubs with them. And I also convinced the nightclub to let me be the director of marketing for them as well. So we booked like Calvin Harris. We booked A-Track. We booked Little John. We booked Alesso. And we were going up against Insomniac and Hard and Avalon. And so was making a lot of noise around like 26, 27 years old doing that. I had a love for underground music. So we started this event called Private Label, where we did like Jamie XX, we did M83, we did Gorgon City, all these really cool acts, Flight Facilities, Bag Raiders, RAC, all these cool acts. This music that I was really personally into. The LA Times ended up writing a full page article on it, which went in their print section, which was really cool. They interviewed me for it. My partner on it was this guy. One of them was named Ian McPherson. He started sending me music, and he had this production partner, Rob May, and they started sending me music, and I really liked it, and I offered to manage them, and they politely declined, and I said, hey, you know, let me come with a plan, and I went to their studio with a manila folder with like a 10-page plan, just kind of the basics of what I was good at and what I wasn't good at and what I was going to strive to be, and they signed with me on the spot, and we blew up this T-shirt campaign, Free Life. I got their shirt on Skrillex, Little John is an old friend, Dylan Francis, Martin Garrix, Cruella, all these amazing artists, Bauer, RL Grime, and we ended up donating like $56,000 to charity. We ended up selling oh man, what was it? It was like 5,000-6,000 units or something in 24 hours. That's and donated bad. Everything to a cancer charity. So Slander was, they had been managed for a couple of months by a buddy of mine who got a job with Swedish House Mafia, and he couldn't manage them anymore. He said, you know, Will's a good guy. He's a talent buyer now. He's blown up this Pixel Boys project a little bit, and you should meet with them. So I met with them. I pitched them. They signed with me the next day. And around this time, I met this guy, Bobby Puma, who was going to hire me as a talent buyer and for this nightclub he was starting. And he decided, he was a wealthier guy, and he decided that he wanted to start a DJ project. So I started managing that. I was booking a bunch of nightclubs. I had started a second talent buying company on that to do more stuff in the Midwest. And I brought on my future partner, Steven Haddad, to help me manage Bobby. So that's when we first got together. Slander, you know, Steven was trying to sign this act, Nightmare. He said, yo, you should sign it with me. I was booking like 9 nightclubs at this time. I was managing Bixel and Slander, and I had started a PR company as well. And I was just like, you know, this is too much for me. And I remember we drove to EDC Las Vegas, and he played me the Nightmare's Jiggy remix. It's probably the first song on his SoundCloud right now. Right. And I was like, oh my God, I have to sign this kid. So We went back to Los Angeles, and I got involved, and we signed Nightmare together. And pretty much right around that time, June 2014, we were like, all right, cool, we're going to start this company together. And it was called Hashtag Juke Life First, because that was the name of his firm and my firm, and it's now Prodigy Artists. And we were managing Jerry Folk, Bearson, Nadia Ali, Bixel Boys, Mo Green, Nightmare, Slander, like all these acts. And Bearson and Jerry Folk left with a partnership, and we did, you know, we don't manage them anymore, and they're doing great, but they're not, you know, as big as maybe they could have been. Pixel Boys ended up firing us. Mo Green ended up firing us. You know, much respect to those guys, but you know, they haven't, like, you know, it wasn't anything like in hindsight that I'm like super disappointed, other than like the ending of like these great friendships that I had with these people. And
I mean, people go their separate ways at some point.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, happens. Well, I'm still friends with all those guys, so it's no big deal. Nadia Ali, she kind of quit the business, and you know, she's like still a good friend of mine. And we really narrowed down our roster. I found my business partner on the talent buying side, Chris Denal. He took over all that stuff, and then I went from having 10 nightclubs and 10 acts to having no nightclubs and 4 acts. And that's when we really got to focus. I ended up, Chris and I started working together. I did a brief stint with LED Golden Voice while I was developing the other nightclubs. And now on the nightclub side, just to kind of bring it full circle and tell you guys where I'm at now, on the nightclub side, which is about 10% of what I do, maybe even less, we have a nightclub in Rosarito called Papas and Beer. We have Gold Room in Atlanta. We have Spire and Clay in Houston. We have Liquid in Madison. We have SWAT Spring Break, and we have Just College Spring Break events. And on the management side, I have Nightmare, Slander, Joyride, Ricky San, and we just signed our first singer, Benny Main, from Toronto. And I kind of ended the PR company, and now I like write articles on the side a little bit too, but it's like 95% management, 3% talent buying, and like 1% writing. I don't even get paid to write anything. I just do it's it more like for a hobby. Fun. Yeah, it's like a hobby.
Okay, word. So I mean, I that's quite a story.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So one thing that I've noticed, at least, is there's a common thread. It seems like you, I'm not going to say you overprepare, because clearly you've, you know, it paid off, but it seems like you really kind of go the extra mile when it comes to preparedness. Like, as far as like getting ready for an interview, or like working with Steve Aoki and like doing the Bixel Boys thing, like, where does that come from, do you think?
Just fear of failure.
Really?
That's it. Yeah. No place else other than that. I am so terrified of failing. You know, I had come from a great family. Like, I wouldn't be like left out on the street or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be homeless if I failed. But I think that that's just what it is. It's just the fear of failure. It's the ambition to realize your full potential. And, you know, as much as I talk about being prepared or whatever, those are a lot of these times where also I had a lot more time on my hands to be prepared, you right. know, now that we're a little overwhelmed. Yeah. Now yeah. we fly by the seat of our pants a little bit more. When we have something big, obviously we'll become prepared, you know, we'll be as prepared as we possibly can be. And I do think that our clients are a little bit more prepared than, you know, some other than what other management firms are doing out there. But generally speaking, yeah, I don't like to lose. I'm really competitive. I don't like to lose at anything.
Right.
So I'm damn sure not going to lose at anything anyone gives me an opportunity to yeah, do, for sure. you know? So yeah, if anyone gives me an opportunity, if anyone opens that door, I'm going to try and storm through it every time. You know?
Did you do well in school?
Yeah. I always did well in school. I was kind of an anomaly throughout my entire academic. I was always like the kid who got in trouble and suspended from school and was hanging out with the wrong kids and getting arrested and doing bad stuff.
Yeah.
But I was always on the honor roll and I was always taking AP courses and I nailed my ACT and my SAT score and I was always a three sport athlete and I was always a bad athlete.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting. I like always played sports, but I was never really good at them. I always did school. I never focused on it, but I always got great grades. I was the oldest of six kids and I was like always in and out of the principal's office or, you know, being handcuffed or whatever.
Like a little bit of a black sheep, but like a straight A black sheep. Almost.
Yeah. It was just weird. I was just everything. I was always a hustler, you know. I was always trying to, I was never like a bad person. I was just always trying to hustle. And sometimes that involved cutting corners or whatever. So
yeah, of course.
But I grew up in Evanston, Illinois, which is like the first suburb north of Chicago. Right. And this is very cultured and like amazing little hub there north of the city.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, it was a wild upbringing to say the least.
Yeah.
Six kids. It was a little bit like, have you seen that TV show Shameless?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Yeah, that was a little bit. That was a little bit like us until I was like sophomore, junior in high school, and then we got to be a little bit more civilized.
But. Yeah, I'm sure it's a lot. It's a lot to manage.
Yeah,
definitely. So, I guess like I kind of reheard this story about Slander and Nightmare, and specifically Slander playing that show, and I'm wondering if you can just kind of like go over that.
Yeah.
Experience the Nicky Romero story.
Yeah. So Slander was playing, I had just signed them a couple, months before that. And we had just signed with Ben Hogan at Circle Talent Agency, who you guys just had on one of your panels.
Yeah.
And,
great guy.
And, they were playing Nocturnal Wonderland. The way the story goes from my angle is I was with Nightmare, who no one knew who he was at the time. And Slander had just played on the second stage, and I remember falling back on the stage because no one told me that there was going to be fire.
Right.
And there was fireballs coming off. And this is stage number two,
right.
mind you. And I fell back, and I was like literally in tears, like, oh my God, like what is going on? This is crazy. Hot. I mean, you could feel this heat on your eyebrows, you know?
Yeah.
And so they get done with their set. I give them a hug. I'm like, oh my God, it was incredible. Go back, run around. I'm with Tyler, and he's like, "Yo, man, I'm so hungry."
Yeah,
and I'm like, "All right, cool, man." You know, he's poorish as heck. You know, paying $680 a month in rent in North Hollywood. He's not the glamorous Nightmare that you know today.
Yeah,
and so we're getting a slice of pizza, and I order two slices. I give him a piece, and we're digging into our gigantic, you know, pepperoni slices or whatever. And I just hear Derek from Slander on the microphone on the main stage, and I'm like, that sounded like Derek. And Tyler's like, no. And then we hear one of their collab songs, like Ascension or Good Vibrations or one of those, and Tyler's like, yo, that's my song, like what is going on? And so we run to the stage. We're like, holy crap, that's Slander on stage, what is going on?
Right.
So I remember running to the left side of the stage, running backstage. There's a security guard right there. And I remember just booking it right around on this ramp and him being like, no, stop. Let me see your credentials. I'm like, that's my client playing up there. And I just ran and I just completely slipped and just busted my ass right in front of him.
Yeah, yeah.
So I couldn't run away. I'm like on the ground, like looking up at him. I'm like, yo, man, I swear to God.
Yeah.
And he didn't let us up for like 15 minutes, and then someone came over and got us and was like, yo, there's 10 minutes left in their set. And I remember being like, yo, Ben, how what the heck happened? And he's like, and, you know, Nicky Romero was flying from Mexico private, and his flight was delayed for whatever reason, and he's not going to make it. So yeah. I was talking to Jasper, and, you know, the guys said that they had an extra 30 minutes of music, so they're up there playing new songs. So I went up to their, you know, the Fireballs are going on the main stage now and they're performing, and I go right in between both, you know, right between both their ankles, and I look up at him and I go, just make sure you keep saying your name on the microphone.
Yeah.
That was it. Just the only thing that I said to them, and I gave them the thumbs up and I walked out. And so I told you I had the PR company. So in the middle of the night at 1 o'clock in the morning, I wrote up a press release on my phone. I had my assistant spell check it. I took a photo that I had Bluetooth or USB'd or whatever, or Wi-Fi'd to my phone from someone.
Yeah.
And I sent out personalized emails to about 20 bloggers at Your EDM, at Dancing Astronaut, this song slaps, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
With the headline, Slander plays biggest show of their lives twice in one night.
Yeah.
And it went up on every freaking blog, everywhere. And Nicky Romero's agent sent me a furious email and was like, yo, I know you freaking did this. And I was like, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about. If you're listening to this, I'm sorry, I lied.
Yeah. Hey, you got to do what you got to do, man.
Yeah, that's, no, it worked. It worked. Yeah. It worked out really well. And that was kind of their, like,
that's the
we have arrived moment. Yeah.
That's the seat of your pants thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
Just like getting that press release.
You can't be prepared. Yeah, exactly.
Just run and gun with
that. Yeah. A lot of management is just flying by the seat of your pants and just grabbing things as they come by and doing the best you can. Because a lot of stuff just, you know, opportunities hit you and you got to make the best of them, like in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
There's no way to be prepared for that.
No. It's just about.
You could be prepared at 1 o'clock in the morning and get that photo we feed to you and all that stuff.
But. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, hearing it from Ben's perspective was like, because apparently,
yeah,
like,
we were on totally different sides of the festival, so
no,
he probably has
going on.
He probably has a totally different story than I do, you know.
Dude, he was basically saying, like,
he was the one who set it up. I didn't do anything.
He basically told me, or told, like, the not me personally, but he told like the whole on the panel. He was talking about how basically they were just next to him. And
yeah.
He just happened to be hanging out. And then he, like, somebody asked, like, we need 30 minutes. Like, somebody's got to give us 30 minutes.
Jasper,
and he was just like,
did, yeah.
You guys want 30 minutes?
It was the second time Ben had done that in his career.
Yeah.
He did it for Bear because Dennis Koyu missed an EDC set. And Bear went up there and ripped a bunch of house tunes and acted like he was Dennis Koyu. Slander did their thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ben's he's the best agent in the world, man.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like when you're given, especially the opportunity that Slander was given, you just kind of have to do your thing as hard as you can do it.
Oh, those boys were ready. They were born to do this. They were born to do it.
Yeah,
they were born to do it. They were ready. They didn't even blink. They were like, yep, ready.
We're
cool.
Doing it.
Plug us in.
Even if like there was the inkling of we may not be ready, it's still,
I mean,
just
these
like,
guys
the
told
up.
Me
we're going for it.
I won't like name names.
Yeah, yeah.
But and the day I met Slander, Derek looked at me and he said, you know, hey, Will, we want to be bigger than, you know,
so and so. Yeah.
And we are not going to stop until we do. So, you know, insert Deadmau5, Tiesto, Calvin Harris, Porter, whatever.
The top of the heap at the time. Yeah, of course.
And he didn't even smirk, or he was not joking
it's
at all.
Like,
he was dead serious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think self-improvement's the name of the game. I'm trying to be the best ever, too.
Yeah, of course.
So that resonated with me, you know, and like really just shooting for the stars and wanting to be the Michael Jordan of your craft or whatever. Anyone who has that ambition, whether or not you have the talent to back it up, if you have that ambition and you have the work ethic to back it up, I want to be on your team.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, those guys, sure. No one's got more worth ethic than those two guys. So yeah.
Real attracts real.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. No, that's cool. And my business partner, Steven's the same way, man. He just, he's a crusher. I'm very proud of everything that we've built over here, and it's a very family-like environment from our employees to our clients. Everybody kind of more or less has approved each other.
Yeah.
When we go and sign a new client, we run it by all of our acts, you know?
You just say, hey, like, yeah, what do you think of this person? Do
exactly.
you like get dinner with them and
yeah,
stuff like
totally.
That?
Totally. And we took Benny Mann, like our new client, to Lollapalooza, and all of our clients went up to him and said, hey, yo, you should sign with these guys. They're really nice people, and they're yeah. really organized, and they're really ambitious, you know?
They're on top of their shit.
Yeah. And he signed with us, and, yeah. You know, anytime we sign a new electronic artist, especially, like, we won't, without their approval, we're not signing anything, you know?
Yeah.
Not saying that we could, because we could if we wanted to, and they would say, all right, cool, we support you, and they would also support that.
Yeah.
But it's good that we've built this kind of exclusive club that's really open-minded, if yeah. you will. Because it's not, like, exclusive in the sense that, like, no new friends, no one else can join, but it's exclusive in the sense that everyone cares about each other, right. and it's a family-like atmosphere, and I think that we're probably one of the few companies who can say that, because a lot of companies just get too big, and it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
But I want to hold on to that ethos as long as possible, and I think my business partner feels the same way, and I think that's yeah. why that's why what we have over here is so special in one guy's opinion, at least.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's important, because people recognize that a lot. You know, people will recognize, like, when they sit down with you guys and they, like, interact and they see how you interact with your artists, like, people are going to see that. And that kind of stuff is, like, that's longevity.
I like to think so. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. No, I think everything has to be thought of in, like, within, like, a 10-year plan, you know, or like a 20-year plan, like, Cash Me Outside girl get signed to, like, Atlantic Records yeah. last week or whatever. It's like, is that really going to be an artist in 20 years? Is that going to be an artist project in
no
20
way.
Years?
Yeah.
Cash Me Outside girls on album number 10 in yeah. 20 years.
I mean, I'd
like,
love to see it happen.
No
like, more
way.
Power to her.
Yeah,
but, like,
more power
not...
to you. If you got bars, baby girl, spit them. Like, yeah. great, you know? But that's just, you know, I think that's everything we do is about 20 years. You know, all the employees that we work with, I think that they think they're going to work here for a long time.
Yeah,
you
for
know?
Sure. And I mean, you also don't want people involved with you that don't think about it.
No,
in that
we
term.
Just gave one of our, you know, assistants, like, a huge raise because she cares.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, it's really hard to find people that are going to care about your business as much as you do. And when you find them, you got to secure them, period. You know, that's something my father taught me. He's an entrepreneur, is that, you know, pay everybody a little bit more than they're worth if you can tell that they care about your company as much as yeah. you do. It's nearly impossible to find. So, yeah, we found a couple awesome people like that. And I think that hopefully, you know, it seems like they're excited to build this thing with us. And that's just what the next 10 years are going to be about.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
just building, you know?
I mean, if we're talking about, so just as, like, a little bit of a pivot. So, you know, we're talking about the next 10 years, next 20 years. I'm wondering, like, where you think it's kind of headed. Specifically,
oh, man.
I ask a lot of people this question. Like,
I got the whole breakdown.
You, I mean, you're probably going to be one of the movers and shakers of it. So
I got,
like,
the whole breakdown of, like, where it is right now, where it's going to go, all that stuff. So
lay it out.
I will. So, you know, you've got, like, deep house and trance music and techno that they more or less remain level. We kind of okay. saw a peak in, like, 2015, and
yeah.
everyone thought, like, deep house was going to be the new craze.
Yeah, of course.
And then it, you know, it was going to be on main stages at festivals across the United States. And then it didn't really happen. You know, it's been happening in Europe for 20 years. Those are the, you know, the festival headliners over
right.
there are, like, Sven Vath and Seth Troxler and stuff like that. So they're no stranger to it. But anyway, those have leveled off, and they're not going to change. We watched 128 die around the end of 2015, which also coincided with the economic bubble mildly deflating. People say bubble burst, but that's just a really hyperbolic statement.
Right.
The bubble didn't burst, but it's slightly deflated. It peaked in 2015. We've now seen it economically plateau in 2017. I don't think it's going to get that much bigger. I don't think it's going to get that much smaller. I think hip hop is the leading genre when in terms of like the new age of punk rock.
Yeah.
We kind of saw that happen with Festival Trap and dubstep because it was like gritty and different and high energy, but it doesn't have the cultural relevance that hip hop music, like the Smoke Perps and the Little Pumps and the Little Peeps.
You're not seeing
and
a lot of like
Tentacions and
you're
all
not
that.
Seeing a lot of dubstep artists getting arrested and stuff like
that.
Like,
they're not part of that. They have no culture.
Yeah.
Their culture is grab rail and eat ecstasy. Like, cool. That's great. The hip hop's doing a lot more culturally. But anyway, so Festival Trap and bass music in general replaced 128 around 2015 as like the new main stage sound, right? Yeah. And you go to festivals now and the main stage is 50 to 80 to 100% bass music, depending on, you know, if you're in Florida or Texas, it's probably a lot of bass music. If you're in New York, it's probably a little bit more house, so on and so forth. And so you've got dance music leveling off economically. You've got Festival Trap becoming the new, and bass music becoming the new main stage sound. And while all that was going down, what transitioned sonically was, via Chainsmokers, was the ability for trap, which is a bass genre, to be a direct conduit to pop music,
right?
Simply because of its tempo.
Yes.
You know, 128 BPM, the only person that was ever able to pull off, and of course that's a, that statement's not 100% accurate, I gotta do my research on that, but generally speaking, the only act to make 128 BPM radio songs is Calvin Harris.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
No one else really did it. Maybe Zedd had one or two in there, but really like multiple
songs maybe.
Yeah, well, yeah, which were with Calvin or, you know,
exactly.
But definitely, no, there's definitely a couple Rihanna songs, a couple Drake songs as well, but generally speaking, you know, the only electronic artist was Calvin Harris.
For sure.
So, trap music became a conduit to pop, and now we're seeing people like the Chainsmokers and Zedd have the opportunity to go DJ pop music or pop edits of pop music on stage, which is kind of where we're at now. What I think 2017 and the next 2 years are going to be, what the focus is going to be, is songs as opposed to tracks. Everybody's writing songs for the radio or songs for their EP or whatever. Nightmare, you know, for example, is a bunch of hip hop songs. Steve Aoki just put out a Colony, which is an entirely hip hop album,
right?
You know, by you know, a guy that's formerly known for his electro anthems, which is no longer a genre at all. You know, Borges and Dioro and all these guys used to be 128 artists are changing their styles, and the guys who don't want to change their styles, Fetty Legrand and Laidback Luke and all these are falling a bit behind. So I think what you're going to see is a movement from a lot of electronic music to just move straight into radio and Spotify, and it's because of technology, it's because of the progression of the genres, the conduit via trap to reach pop music, etc., etc. So it's going to be really interesting watching all these producers try their chops at songwriting,
right?
You know, which is, I think, well, you know, we've seen San Holo go ahead and be successful at it. Lewis the Child is a great example of people who are successful at it.
Right.
There's always going to be a need for hands in the air music, as we like to call it.
Yeah.
But I think what we're going to watch in electronic music is a lot of these guys go take a stab at highly accessible music, and you can put that in whatever genre you can make it accessible in. To put it in its simplest term, I would call it pop music.
Right, of course.
Yeah, and while dubstep is making a resurgence in the underground,
right?
You know,
I mean, there's always going to be that.
It's the cycle,
always,
right? Yeah. So, you know, once every pop song is made, and every, you know, Diana Ross and, you know, Walking on Broken Glass, whatever, has been covered and changed into a spinning records tune or whatever, then we'll probably have another, you know, cycle into, maybe it'll be deep house next, maybe it'll go back to 128 in a more gritty way, maybe, you know, bass house will you know, I feel like every bass house song's already been made, but, you know, maybe a whole entire new genre will develop.
Right.
I think predicting past 18 months or 2 years in a genre of music like the electronic sphere, which changes so rapidly, is just it's arrogance.
Yeah, no,
nearly, you definitely. Know, and I don't even know that I say none of this with complete assurity,
right?
You know, whatsoever. Who like really knows
what you're planning for, basically?
Yeah. I think once, you know, you make a bunch of street cred tunes, which is like hard to do, which is the hands in the air stuff, mm-hmm. then you go make music that everybody likes.
Yeah.
And that's it. So, and if you don't want to make music that everybody likes, then don't.
Yeah.
You know, Nightmare doesn't necessarily want to make pop tunes. He still wants to make hands in the air music. I think, you know, segueing into like advice for producers is no matter what the trends are, make what's in your heart, period.
Yeah.
And if you know the pop is trending, and you try to, as soon as you start, you know, Joyride and Derek from Slander and everyone will tell you this, as soon as you start making music that tries to appease someone, it will come out like shit.
Yeah,
period.
Yeah,
it just will. So yeah, I think you gotta always make what's in your heart, and if there's a part of your heart that, I mean, I love Drake, I love Beyonce, yeah, personally, definitely. You know, like if I was a songwriter, I could write accessible music because that's what I like, you know.
Definitely.
So, but some of these guys don't, you know. I don't think Joyride's ever gonna make like straight pop jams.
Yeah.
Will he make stuff that's accessible? You know, like Smack My Bitch Up was accessible, you know, The Prodigy in 1998 or whatever. Yeah, I think he will, and I think that's gonna be his lane, is accessible music with a super gritty edge to it that, you know, like Nine Inch Nails or Marilyn Manson, you know.
Yeah,
so, but we'll see. He's gonna be an interesting project to watch develop as well.
For sure. One of the other things that I'm interested in as well is kind of how you're seeing electronic artists shift in the way they perform.
Sure.
Like I know the Chainsmokers did their live tour.
Yeah.
I know like Flight Facilities has done like some live shows.
Yeah, I booked them a bunch for their live set.
And I'm wondering, like, do you see any of your art? I don't want to spoil anybody or anything you guys might have plans for, but like, are you seeing at least the dudes that are more of the hardcore DJ guys, like, are they starting to open up to that live stuff, or can you speak on that?
I can speak on that, just like even more so, like, you know, the sneak preview of what my guys are doing, just like talk about strategically, you know, like what's a good move, what's a bad move. You know, we just watched OK have a great performance at Nocturnal Wonderland, his debut live performance. Me personally, I put myself in the shoes of the patron, right? I saw Muramasa last October at the Fonda Theater.
Okay.
One of my favorite artists. You know, he had a real minimal setup. He was up there by himself. You know, he's got a bunch of jams that I like, and it was cool. You know, it was fun. But if he did what maybe the Gorillaz, like, well, I saw the Gorillaz at the Aragon Ballroom in, like, I don't know, 2009 or something like that. And, you know, it's not the same vibe, but it's similar vibe. The Gorillaz is like all out freaking orchestra at times. So that's like not the best comparison. But what they brought along with the orchestra was this cinematic experience, you know? So if Muramasa had more of like a visual aspect or more like lasers, and maybe I'm just being like the most EDM guy ever, but in terms of like Slander and Nightmare, you know, they have their Good Vibrations, like gigantic, like three-story high Atom, which is very it's huge. For lack of a better word, it's imposing is the word I'm looking for. It definitely leaves you, you know, it burns itself in your brain. You can't unsee that thing, essentially. Nightmare is going to be developing, I could tell you something and it might change, but something, you know, within his brand, maybe something with like a huge sphere in it, and he's going to DJ around it, you know. So when you talk about these like 20-foot high production setups, you know, maybe like what Excision has, or maybe Skrillex Mothership Tour, or Epic 5.0 with Eric Prydz, or whatever it is. Is that more, I'm going to use the word again, is that more imposing to you than beating on electronic drum pads?
Right.
And maybe like singing a song that's yours, where to make it sound right, you're probably going to need the backing vocal up at like 85, 90%,
of course,
anyway. And maybe you improvise a little bit here and there, but if you want it to sound good, you're not going to be all that live. Mm-hmm. So in terms of choosing one or the other, because they're not traditional musicians who play five different instruments, And in terms of talking like strategy, I think for my guys, and this is not universal, but for my guys, it's more important to invest in that
production,
insane, one of a kind. Oh my freaking God. Anyone can go up there and play live for one.
Yeah.
If you build a custom design stage, that's going to beat every guitar and every drum kit and every single time, you know.
Yeah.
Porter Robinson and, like we said, Gorillaz, these are like great examples of doing both.
Yeah.
Where you have an amazing visual package and you're performing live. So I think live would come second to me. Can we build out something live that goes along with an amazing production package? I think that will advance the careers of my clients faster than going up there with a skeleton style. With right. having that be, the
like
the first
selling.
Thing you okay. do, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, instead of having the first thing you do play with a bunch of instruments, I think the first thing you do is have a great production setup and then look at live after that to up the ante, you know, one
right.
more. The one thing with like all these guys going live, it's like, all right, that's cool, but like, you know, what are you going to do for the next 20 years?
Right.
You can't really take it to the next level. Like, let's go live on like year 6 or 7, you know?
Right.
Like Above and Beyond did a bunch of DJ sets, and then when they did acoustic at the Greek Theater, it was like, holy shit,
right,
this is crazy, like yeah. we got to see this, you know. So yeah, and then the production thing is like another thing you can change every 24 months as well to
yeah.
keep that wow factor going. I mean, Excision and Datsik are two great examples of guys that, you know, that they'll put out, you know, Datsik had a song with Snoop and stay relevant. You know, Excision put out like the greatest dubstep album of all time. But even, you know, maybe they're a year away from releases, but they come out with the Shogun setup or, you know, whatever it is. And they kick, you know, a breath of fresh air into their product, you
yeah.
know, project. Whereas it's like, all right, cool. We upgraded our guitar today and only the guitar kids are going to be like, oh my God, that's a Les Paul like
right.
from 1968. I can't believe he has that,
yeah.
you know? So,
I definitely feel like the live aspect, there's a little bit of a like a music nerd aspect to it. I can understand like wanting to just nerd out and get a bunch
totally.
Of gear and mess around with it, you know.
Yep. Also keep in mind, I think probably 95% of their songs are programmed.
Yeah.
Not played. You know, they
yeah,
might
exactly.
play a melody on a MIDI controller
yeah.
or whatever, but generally speaking, they're not sitting there going, all right, cool, here's a live, record that, loop that, or whatever. All right, here's another instrument. Let's, because then you're kind of more like, oh, yeah, I want to show the world
sense.
that I, what really, you know, and I have like a funny example. Like, we did a remaking of Nightmare making his first big hit, Street, or whatever. And we were like, yo, can you like play it on the keyboard? And he was like, no. Like,
yeah.
I program this, and
yeah.
we were like, all right, we'll fake it.
Yeah.
So like, he, you know, played the notes on the keyboard and we like superimposed it, and you know, it ended up working out or whatever. But yeah, I mean, they don't, you know, there's very little instrument playing going on in the composing of their songs, you
yeah
know?
It's definitely a little more of a programming,
yeah,
you know what I mean, and
yeah,
programming, editing and feeling it out and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So we did talk about, you did mention Spotify and how it's kind of running the game right now. And I think that's
yeah.
really, it's kind of king.
Streaming in general. Yeah.
Streaming is definitely king. But with streaming also gives you data and like, you can see where your listeners are.
Sure.
And you can see, just kind of like your entire audience. Like, you can find out that you have people listening in a particular town in
yeah.
some city and you didn't know about any of that. And I'm wondering, just kind of what steps you're taking at Prodigy to just take advantage of big data. Like, what?
I think when we were planning out Joyride's tour, we had like a strong discussion about Melbourne, putting it on there, and a lot of it was based on Spotify monthly listeners, how many Spotify monthly listeners we had there.
Right.
Just in terms of, you're just talking about like the data analytics aspect.
Yeah, just
of
like, because you're,
yeah,
you're
like,
a marketing guy and
yeah.
stuff. So like, I want to know.
That's one. That was like one aspect of like how we've used the data. Another way was Nightmare has a 16 city Nightmare Before Christmas tour coming up here
okay.
in December. And we sent out direct emails to all the Spotify users and offered them tickets a day before all the entire tour came out to tickets for the 16 of the shows or whatever. Spotify did like a huge email blast to notify everyone. They had like 12 hours to buy tickets.
Right.
I think we ended up doing a pretty much 10%. You're only allowed to sell 10%. I think we sold out all of our allotments for every, you know, got 10% of the tickets out of the way for every single market 24 hours before the tour was announced.
Yeah.
So wasn't mad at that. In terms of the playlist, they have there's a service that we use to find out like every single playlister, every curator that's put one of our songs on their playlist.
Okay.
Then you're going and hitting those people up and just thanking them.
Yeah.
You know, hey, thanks for putting my record on your playlist. Like, we'll have another release out in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't mind, we'll contact you here, et cetera, et cetera. But generally speaking, just, I think the touring is like the most important thing. Just like, we looked up, you know, they were trying to get us to go out to India, and we weren't really convinced that we should go to India until they got the fee to where we wanted. But then we also looked and we're like, oh man, there's a ton of people on Spotify listening to our music in India. So those are just kind of finding your fans is one really important aspect of the data analysis with Spotify, I'd say.
Cool. You say you have a singer now.
Yeah, Benny.
Is he, what genre, like what lane is he in? What genre is he?
It's like dirty pop, I would call it. It's like dirty pop R&B. It's a lot of just like songs about alcoholism and depression and drug abuse and
right.
breaking, you know, getting your heart broken by your girlfriend, by jobs.
Yeah.
Just a lot of anguish and
feels.
And yeah, I think that's what, you know, he's 25 years old. I think that's what the younger generation is. You know, they're a lot more sensitive than I was.
Yeah.
You know, like I wrote an article about everyone being like, don't listen to Tentacion's album.
Yeah.
And I sent it to my aunt, who's a professor, to edit it. And she accidentally sent it. I have the same name as my father. And she ended up sending it to my father. And my dad was like, this is some fucking pussy shit. Like, going to tell you what to listen to and not what not to listen to? What the heck? Release Snowflake. Everybody's just so, but you don't want to know what that stuff really resonates with the kids. I think they're dealing with anxiety and depression in a whole nother way that we were, you know? And I think that, you know, you never had it in hip hop music. You always had it in punk music and emo music and depression and all these and suicide and all these topics. And in 2003, when I was listening to hip hop music, I mean, hip hop artists were gods to us.
Yeah.
You know, Cameron, Tupac, Ice Cube, all the, you know, they, Tupac and Biggie and Nas, they all talked about suicide once in 10 albums.
Right.
You know, I even looked it up. Like, they all at least have one line that says, you know, I wanted to kill myself. I almost fucking ended it, blah, 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 whatever.
Yeah.
You go listen to Tentacion album. He's got 10 songs about committing suicide.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that just resonates with the kids these days. And Benny's stuff is like really upbeat and it's kind of like sad topics. And even when he is kind of feeling confident or, you know, telling songs, it's about like, being, you know, then it's about like manipulating women and, you know, and that these are things that happened in his life and that he went through. I don't think it's anything that he's proud of, but just like any artist, he put pen to paper. He told me he like blacks out and then it just like shows up and then he records it and he sends me a new song like every 3 days. As soon as he gets a beat, I get a song. So he's really a seminal talent. I think he's going to be really big one day. I think he's just an amazing songwriter. And I personally like all of his music, which is, which speaks to me because I'm a audiophile in every sense of the word. I listen to more music than anyone that I know. And if that means I listen to your song for 7 minutes, I listen to your whole fucking song.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's not to say that I actually listen to your whole song, but when it comes to electronic music, I can listen to it very quickly, you know?
Yeah.
And just watching all these hip hop artists blow up, it's all about the story. You know, and he's got a wild, you know, slept on people's floor, washed dishes story. And half of it comes out through his lyrics and half of it have already come out through his lyrics, that stuff that we've made. And I'm sure he's got another 5 albums of struggle in, with him. And when he gets successful, maybe he'll make songs about that, you know?
So how, different is it to manage somebody like him as compared to like, cause he's probably like the first dude. I mean, it's done
complete opposite.
Yeah.
I managed a hip hop artist called Prob Cause. That was the first act. That was actually the first act. I didn't mention him.
Okay.
But that was the first act I actually managed. That was before Bixel Boys. That was when I was doing all the rap concerts and I put him on all the rap shows.
Yeah.
And you know, I had no idea what I was doing, so you can't really like compare it, but, everything's the total opposite. In terms of kind of like big goals and checkpoints, you know, to give you an easy example with Slander and Nightmare, we put them on the road as headliners. Perception is reality. We don't want to be the second name on a flyer that's smaller. We're the big guns. You should know who we are. Boom. Right. That's my touring strategy when it comes to dance music. If you go look at Nav, if you go look at Smoke Perp, if you go look at all these up and coming urban artists right now, all these dudes, even Travis Scott is going on tour with Kendrick Lamar.
Right.
You know, everybody is going on a support tour. They're going on 3, 4, 5 support tours in a row before doing their own headline thing. You know, even DJ Khaled's not really out there doing like hard ticket shows by himself.
Yeah,
you know, he's on festivals.
Well, he's not really making music by himself.
Yeah, he's on festivals.
Yeah.
He's on nightclubs. But it's just this weird thing, you know. I think I've seen like Juicy J do hard ticket touring and like House of Blues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like everybody just does the really big, the 5,000 to the cap to the stadiums, and they just stack up these huge lineups. And that's the way urban artists are built these days, through support, through multiple support shows with other artists, which is complete opposite of dance music, you know.
Right. What was the learning process for that like? Like, did you have to like...
I just study. I just look at tour flyers all day.
And you just like see what's going on.
Yeah, like every time I see a tour flyer, like I was teaching my assistant the other day, like how to analyze a tour flyer, you know? And I know every hard ticket room. In North America is my specialty, but I know every hard ticket room and every market. You know, you look up the ticket price and I could tell you how much that guy got paid. Literally, okay. Like to the... within $2,500 of what they got paid. Because not only I've seen all the offers, I've sent a ton of offers, you know, I know how what the expenses are like in a certain room or whatever. So, you know, if you go look at, you know, Nav, for example, is on tour with The Weeknd and Belly, I think is who's above him. Travis Scott, like I just said, is, you know, was on tour with Kendrick Lamar. Future, even though Future put out like a double album, he still went on tour with Drake, you know? So if you're telling me guys worth $100,000 are still going on tour with other artists, you know, I think it's just like a cool by association type thing. You know, if you want to relate it to dance music, it's like, you know, all these guys taking photos with each other and cross promoting each other on social media. There's totally, that's one similarity, you know? Nav wants to go hang out with Belly and The Weeknd and be in all their photos and cross promote that way. But I think it goes to a farther extent. And I think the reason why is because a lot of the DJs are made based off their brand and how big you can make them feel and what that perception is. And we pride ourselves on building that perception. When it comes to hip hop, it's all about the music. Your song's good or it's not. They don't care what size you are on the flyer. People go buy tickets to The Weeknd just to see Nav. They'll pay $75. You know, I remember watching Poolside open up for The Rapture because I just love their music so much, you know?
Yeah.
So if you like the music, you're going to go to the concert, whether or not, you know, whereas in electronic music, there's not enough good music to go around. There's not enough hits to go around. The openers don't have hit records. Not like, oh man, I got to go see Dombreski opened up for Slander. That's who we have support on our tour. And he's like a fucking super rad DJ. He's incredible. He's a really good producer. He's got a bunch of songs that I like. He even has a song on Chami's label that you probably actually have heard before, but you can't name it, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're like Nav, you know, you've got songs with 70 million Spotify plays and you're still doing support shows, you know? So it's just a different way of building artists. And it's just very musical and very cosign driven. And, you know, in electronic music, if you get a hit, you just go headline, you never look back.
Yeah.
Ever.
Like you're tenured once you get your hit.
You know, I think guys that have hit songs or that have, amazing studio careers and have put out all this great music and they've gone and done a headline tour. Like I'm thinking of two names in my head that I don't want to say right now, cause I don't want to be rude, but once people take a step back, I think the kids know it. And they're like, oh shit, this is not hot anymore. Wait,
yeah.
wait.
Yeah.
because he played the Palladium before, and now he's just playing the club in town. Maybe he's not hot. Okay. And they know. They feel it. They, some, these LA kids especially, they can feel the ebb and flow of like the music industry, if you will.
Who to buy and sell, basically.
Yeah, like, you know, if you're not hot anymore, it's a quick fall in dance music.
Yeah.
And in hip hop, you could stick around, you know? There's guys like Big Crit and like, what's his name? God, there's so many freaking Cleveland rappers, but you know, like Currency's a great example. You know, Currency doesn't have a hit, you know, but he's forever. Currency is forever. Currency right. is the Tech Nine of our generation. Yeah, you yeah. know, he's just gonna be around forever, and it's because he has a great body of work, and he doesn't need a hit song, and it's gonna stick. Electronic, it's a little bit harder. You can have that body of work, but to go to the next level, you know, Tech Nine can go get a $50,000 paycheck. It's yeah. tough to get one of those in electronic music unless you have that like big song, you know?
Yeah.
Or I guess you gotta go a little bit higher than that. But yeah, it's definitely it's a wild, wild west out there, man. We're still making it up as we go along.
Yeah, for sure. So we're running a little low on time because I want to cool. get two more things in. So I am wondering, I'm actually very curious because like, I'm wondering, say you do have a rock and roll band.
Yes.
That you're super into and you're vibing with.
Yeah.
How would you approach managing a rock and roll band? And like, what would be your angle? Because it's like, I guess I'm not going to say a dead genre because like there are plenty of rock and roll bands that are still kicking a lot of ass.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't have the same, you know, sort of hotness in the way that
yeah
EDM and hip hop does.
I guess I would just kind of dance musicify everything, just apply, because I don't know that much about rock music, so
yeah,
just like kind of how I came into the Bixel Boys meeting 5 years ago. It's kind of like one of those things where you outline all the stuff you're good at and then you say, hey, but this is all the stuff I don't have, because that's right. what I told them in that first meeting. I was like, this is all the stuff I'm gonna strive to be. So coming from a position of naivety and just really not knowing what I'm doing, I would, you know, track down all the people that, and this could just apply to like anyone, you know, say, yeah. starting in the music industry, you got a genre, what do you do?
Yeah.
I would track down all the playlisters in that. I would definitely, you know, I'm a absolute listener of Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and Steve Miller Band and Steely Dan and all that stuff. But modern rock, I would have to do what I did working for Aoki in 2011 and lock myself in a room with some headphones on for 5 hours a day and learn.
Do your research.
Yeah, and yeah. do my research and find out. You know, that's what I've been listening to rap music for 18 months now, a year and a half right. now, in preparation of having like an urban act. And it's in my blood. It's like what I grew up on. But I can't listen to hip hop songs for 8 seconds and know if it's going to be a hit or not, like I can with electronic music. So I'll get there though.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I've gotten to a place where I can at least spot the voices. Heard Kendrick Lamar the first time 6 years ago or yeah. whatever. And I was like, this is over. This guy's going to be huge.
Yeah.
You know, like I think if Lil Yachty got a little bit better writers, he could be the biggest artist in the world.
Right.
He has like this Biggie Smalls style, like real deep, unique,
yeah.
cool voice, you know? So, but in terms of that, yeah, I would look up all the Spotify playlisters. I would download every, I would look up, you know, I would go to Coachella and all the Lollapaloozas and go to all their rock stages, and I would listen to all the music and that was on the rock stages. Then I would go look up all their touring history
right.
on their Instagram, see what all the venues that they were playing is. I'd go market by market. I'd write down all the venues that all the guys that were, you know, a step ahead of us were playing, or what venues acts were breaking in. I would look at all the acts that all the acts that were in that lane, all those same acts, I would go to all their Facebook pages and I would write down all their agents and all their agencies, and I would start to build rosters of who's, you know, where are these rock acts conglomerating in terms of agencies? What's the strong rock agency? in terms of, yeah, the festivals, whether it's like C3 or AEG or Live Nation or whatever, I would see, you know, all right, who are the talent buyers like in this, you know, do I know any of the talent buyers? Are any of the guys that buy dance music, are they also buying rock music? Can they introduce me? Can Bobby Clay at C3 introduce me to the guy who books all the rock stages at Lollapalooza? I'm sure they can, you know. Can Milo at Insomniac introduce me to the Live Nation guy who's, you know, I'm kind of going through the, you asked me about rock music, but I'm kind of going through this right now with hip hop music, and I'm kind of just telling you what I would do with hip hop music. And I think it just applies to all genres.
It's like a universal thing.
Yeah. If you want to talk about like, what would I do that's like rock specific, it's like, shit, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you next year though.
But you'd figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll tell you next year when I have my rock band for a year and we've started knocking down those doors and stuff like that. But no, I mean, it's just it's a complete mystery to me, you know, but that's what a guy that doesn't know shit would do. So
yeah,
that's my answer.
But that's also probably the smartest. Even if you think you know shit, that's probably still the smartest thing you can do.
Well, if you think you know shit, you're probably the dumbest person in the room, right?
Yeah, there you go. So, and then just two more little things, and then I think we're good. Say you have an artist, I'm going to say a producer in his bedroom, and he wants to get a manager and he wants to make it big.
Yeah.
What is your sort of your nugget, your Instagrammable nugget of advice that you would give to
make 10 original signable finished tracks and don't email anyone until you have those. Finn.
That's it.
Yes.
And just get your 10 heaters and then you're good.
Yeah. If you got 10 heaters that are all over the place, probably going to be in trouble. If you got 10 heaters that are all in the same lane, probably going to be good. That's a great start because you can switch lanes after those 10 songs.
Yeah.
You know, you can pivot after that. But you got to establish your brand sonically, you know, through that music. You know, I have so many kids who email me one song or one remix.
Right.
You know, and then you're like, all right, well, where's more? And they're like, oh, we'll send you more soon. It's like, all right, you're done forever. Goodbye. You know, so it's just, it's really hard out there. You're competing against, you know, 50,000 other kids who have a MacBook in Ableton.
Yeah.
Who took piano lessons.
Yeah.
You know, so the competition is really stiff. And I think that's why a lot of great electronic music is coming to the forefront now. And why a lot of these producers that made 128 back and they can't pivot to trap. They can't pivot to pop music. They don't have the ability.
Yeah.
I mean, even the guy like Afrojack, I think we're little enough that we can talk trash about Afrojack on this program. But like, even like a guy like Afrojack who like has 7 Ferraris and whatever, like he never made a song that wasn't 128 BPMs in his life.
Well, Afrojack is Afrojack. Yeah. That's what Afrojack does.
Yeah, that's what Afrojack does. So, you know, I think the only people that are going to have 20-year careers are the songwriters.
And the ones that can pivot and
that's
change.
What we were talking about a half an hour ago, you know, so... We'll see. It's definitely an interesting time for dance music. We are in dance music's, and this is going to be me really naive saying this as well, but we're in, I'll clean up my statement. Here we go. We are in the biggest transition period in dance music since my career in dance music started, which has been 6 years.
Yeah.
This is the biggest transition period of the last 6 years by far.
Yeah.
In so much as to say that I saw... We're in the middle of what I call the trapocalypse. It's ending right now.
The trapocalypse,
the trap era. I even did a Facebook post in like 2013 or 14 that called the demise of 128, like 2 years in advance.
Right.
Okay. I'm calling the demise of trap music right now. Do I know what's next other than pop sensibility? No. Which is really exciting.
Yeah. Because it could be anything.
Yeah. Who knows?
And then just the same piece of advice, but for a kid who wants to be a manager, who basically somebody who wants to be your job. I guess like the better way to phrase it is like, I'm not sure how old you are. You look.
I'm 30.
Not a day over 21.
I'm 30. Okay. 31 next month.
So what advice would you give to your 23-year-old self, fresh out of college?
But yeah, be overly prepared and be indispensable. When I left the first events company, someone else's company I joined, it crumbled. You know, all kids asking me like, how do you get a job? Well, you go work somewhere, and if you threaten to leave, they're screwed. You did a good job. And that's the only answer.
Yeah.
Become indispensable. If they can easily replace you, you've done nothing. And that goes for management. That goes for any job. So the answer to becoming a manager is the answer to getting any job, which is show up overprepared and make yourself indispensable. And that's it. Be
simple as that.
It's as simple as that. But to be more like specific, you know, if you have the luxury of doing a free internship, pick a very small company and climb to the top of it. If you need pay right away, you probably are going to have a longer journey to making a ton of cash or being independent or whatever. But if you don't have that luxury, totally understandable. It's understandable. You know, go work for $28,000 a year for a great management firm and be overprepared and indispensable, yeah. You know, and that's it, you know, and just apply to, you know, just apply to where all your favorite artists are at.
Yeah.
You know, because the reason why my job's so easy is because I love my clients' music. It's just really fun to work on stuff that you like, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I would do. You know, I think the younger generation has a lot of excuses, and I don't mean to generalize about people, but it just, when I showed up, I was definitely competing with other killers out there, people who wanted it just as bad as I was. And now I like look around and I'm like, where's the good assistants at even? Like, I don't even know where, you know, oh man, I would really love this assistant at William Morris or yeah. This, you know, if I had a bigger budget, I'd snatch this person from, I don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's an interesting time, you know, it's a different, interesting time for United States economically and interesting time for kids and interesting time for college diplomas and interesting time for owning houses and all of that.
Dude, this so, is like, we're in this, this is like
yeah.
The most, I mean, you're saying like, you know, this is the biggest time for EDM change wise and stuff like that. The
United
like,
States too.
This is a culture. Game changer.
Yeah, music yeah. represents culture, represents, you yeah. know, economics and society right. and everything's a mirror of itself, you know?
So. Yeah. Well, before we get too far down that rabbit hole, it is, I think it is about that time, to wrap up. Thanks cool. so much.
Dude, thanks for having me, man. That was
yeah,
a blast.
This was great. Definitely. Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks a lot.
No problem. Yeah. Anytime you want me back, I'm here.
Cool. So that's our show. For those of you that don't know, we host a monthly panel here in Los Angeles. It's a great place to get FaceTime with true industry professionals, meet other people in the industry who are eager to learn and build, and then also just learn a bunch of valuable lessons a lot faster than just doing it on your own. I learn something new there every single month. If you want to keep up with all the Industry Talks news and then find out when and where our next panel is taking place, go to our website, industrytalks.net. Also, we just launched our Twitter account for this podcast. It's at @INDTalksPodcast. Give us a follow there. Give us some feedback on this episode or any prior episode. You know, questions that you'd want to see, guests that you'd want to see, that kind of stuff. And if you're listening to this on iTunes or Google Play and you like what you're hearing, we would really appreciate a 5-star rating. It really does go a long way. Thanks for listening.